Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guests today are Sven Carlson and Jonas Leijonhufvud, authors of the Spotify play, How CEO and Founder Daniel Ek Beat Apple, Google, and Amazon in the Race for Audio Dominance. The book was published in English in February 2021 by Diversion Books, and is currently being adapted by director Per Olof Sørensen as a Netflix miniseries. 15 years ago in Stockholm, Daniel Ek and Martin Lorentzen had an idea. The music industry was desperately trying to hold back the tide of piracy via file sharing, but this was proving as hopeless as the war on drugs. Why not, they thought, use the new torrenting technologies to make piracy legit and themselves rich? In 2006, they founded the company with a handful of engineers, no licenses, and no revenue. Even the company name was an accident after Lorentzen misheard Ek's suggested name and bought the Spotify.com domain license. Today, Spotify is the world's most popular audio streaming subscription service with 345 million users and with a market capitalization of $60 billion. Business bookshelves are full of rags-to-riches biographies of Amazon, Twitter, Airbnb, Uber, and Netflix, but until now there's been nothing in English on Europe's one tech giant. Finally, Swedish journalist Sven Carlson and Jonas Leijonhufvud have filled the gap with a book based on interviews with more than 80 sources and a mountain of public and private documents. Sven is a technology reporter at Swedish Radio, who went to school in Moscow and New York. Jonas was raised in Stockholm and Arizona, is a veteran business reporter who is now at the digital subsidiary of Dagen Industry. Sven and Jonas, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
As I may have hinted in the intro there, I've been waiting for this book to come for a long time. I read Brad Stone's Everything Store, Nick Hilton's Hatching Twitter, and Lee Gallagher's Airbnb story, but there was no equivalent out there on Spotify, so thank you. After following the company for so long, what made you decide to write the original Swedish book, and why write together?
I mean, I think the Spotify story sort of got something of a there was an end to the book that we could envision once they were listed on the stock exchange. Because really, I mean, there were existential questions that surrounded the company for a long time. You know, would this business model work? Would the artist community accept what they were doing? A lot of those things were not given, you know, if you just look back a few years. And so by the time that they reached the stock exchange, it felt like here's, you know, this is, we could now do, we could try and sort of chronicle the, what Daniel Ek would call the sort of first inning of the company's history. And writing together, well, I don't know, Jonas, how did that happen?
We were colleagues at the Dagens Industry and writing about tech companies, and this was the biggest tech story of them all. And I'd been thinking for years about writing a book about Spotify, but it was a very, very secret company. And it was hard to sort of get good sources that had seen it all from the inside. But once the company was going to be listed on Wall Street, we realized that a new era of transparency sort of was on the horizon for Spotify, and that probably it would be easier to get people to talk about the early days also as a result of that. And we had a few sources between the two of us, and we talked about it a little bit. And Sven actually had his own ideas and had booked a meeting with one of the big publishing houses in Stockholm. So he wasn't sure that he wanted to write this book together with me. But then I also had a good publishing source, and eventually we pitched it together. And they said yes right away. We didn't have much to start out with, but we knew that there's a great story there. And if we, you know, between the two of us, we had enough sources to get started. And it's been a really interesting adventure to try to find our way into the story. Because Spotify, it's an unofficial corporate biography. So Spotify has declined interviews specifically for the book. We've interviewed Daniel and Martin as journalists several times throughout the years, and continue to cover the company as journalists. But for this book, they have not participated in any way. Neither the founders nor the company. So we've had to rely on a lot of off-record sources, and as you mentioned, over 80 sources in total. Mm.
And how did you write it? Do you take a chapter each, or how did you do it?
Actually, I focused on the early years and Sven on the later years. So that was one way of dividing it up. But then we've gone into each other's parts, and so we've done it all together in the end, and we've read out loud to each other a lot. And so there isn't a sentence in this book that we haven't both sort of tinkered with, I'd say.
Yeah, I didn't notice any change in style between any of the chapters. So that seems to verify that.
A lot of sitting out at Sven's dad's summer house in the archipelago of Stockholm and reading the book aloud to each other and just going crazy over all the changes and arguing and so on with each other about how to put this together. So a lot of passionate discussions, never any breakups. It made the book better that we've been each other's editors, kind of.
And the original book was published in 2019 in Sweden, and by the time we were translating the English version, we also had the opportunity to add a lot of research and reporting that really sort of clarified a few important things and gave us some more sort of character depth, I think, in terms of Daniel and in terms of a few other key people. So I'm quite happy, and I think Jonas is too, with this English language version, because it feels like it's sort of up to date and just a little more fleshed out. So we're glad that it's finally out.
Did you find that some of the people who hadn't spoken to you for the Swedish edition approached you because they wanted to put the record straight, or they wanted to say something to get into the English edition?
Well, kind of the other way around, but when we went knocking on some of the same doors that had been closed to us in the first round, we noticed that some of them opened up because people realized, oh, it's gonna come out in English in the States, and maybe the response to the first version of the book was positive enough that they dared talk. So yeah, some people decided to contribute that said no to us in the first round, and a lot of people that have seen the story from the inside feel a great degree of personal loyalty to Daniel and to the company, and so you can understand that they were sort of hesitant when we came knocking and they didn't know who we were. It helped that the book had gained some traction by the time we translated and updated it for the English version.
And tell me about the Netflix thing. When did you first hear about that?
Early on, and it was the production company Yellowbird that was interested in buying the film and television rights, and then they finally did, and then more months passed, and then they sold it to Netflix. So the situation with that is that we're not part of that production at all, and we're not consulting, we're not part of it at all. And I think that's probably a good thing, because we're still, as journalists, covering the company. And so it's just as well to keep these things separate. You know, we don't want to sort of answer for what Netflix and Yellowbird are going to do with this. But I mean, it's a drama, it's a dramatization. So it will be based on a true story, I'm guessing. It's two separate worlds, really. Very separate projects. We're not a part of it.
I mean, it's the ideal thing to be trying to film at a time of at the time of pandemic, because there's never going to be more than a handful of people in the room at any time. I don't know how far they've got with it.
We can't really answer to that, but it will be interesting to see how they create drama in this kind of a story. Maybe it will be like Margin Call or one of those films, you know, that have a certain intensity to them, despite taking place inside offices to a great extent. I'm really excited to see what the end result is of this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, coming to the book, it was really funny reading it to realize how long ago 2006 seemed. Even the really crucial moments of the development of the company in 2012, 2013, because the technology has moved so quickly over that time. I mean, I'd actually forgotten that Spotify was a desktop product originally, and had to move very quickly into the mobile app for survival. Was it a similar experience for you in the writing?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge covering technology generally, that it moves fairly quickly, and you're as a consumer, at least, it's sort of intuitive, and you're just using it, and you sort of quickly forget the rapid advances. And I think that we had to sort of reimagine what those times were like when we were writing about those years that you mentioned. I mean, it was very much a desktop product. Spotify did not go really mobile first until, I mean, quite late, as you mentioned, you know, 2013, 14, 15 even. And those were, yes, very different times. I mean, the main competitor were MP3 players. I mean, chiefly the iPod. And, you know, we a lot of us will remember those, but that's also quite a different way of consuming music and an entirely different business model that, you know, really Spotify upended.
Yeah, and we divided it up, me taking the early years and Sven taking the later, because I was a young business reporter in 99 when the story kind of starts with Martin Lorentzen, who was one of the two founders, building his fortune with a company called Trade Doubler. We trace a little bit of that too. So I'm the older one of us who sort of remembers.
you were actually a part of the sort of booming Stockholm tech scene for a brief while, right?
Well, I in 98 I worked for a web design company, so I saw that world from the inside a little bit in the first .com bubble, which is sort of when Daniel was still in high school and Martin was building his first fortune, which he later invested in Spotify. I kind of have a feel for that time and the excitement of that time, and also where the technology was, which was someplace completely different. It was all sort of very new and destined to sort of fall on its face. A lot of the first iterations of these great ideas, Spotify started in 2006. That's kind of late in the game. There were a lot of companies that had tried this out before. So they were lucky to come in not too early. Just, I think they came in at the right time, like right before the smartphone revolution, which is really what's sort of carried them into to all our lives and made them become a company that can be, that have users in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah, I spent a fair amount of time in Stockholm in the early noughties myself for my job. And I remember it as this very booming sort of hip tech hub place. But I'd forgotten that some of these companies were Swedish, like Skype and Kazaa, and even part of SoundCloud.
And also
the point you make, it was the spiritual home of European piracy. could you outline how that happened, how it was that Sweden became this legit but also non-legit hub?
I mean, I think there's a number of factors there. Obviously, internet usage was kind of early in Sweden. Our broadband networks were sort of rapidly built out in the 1990s. And so we had speeds that were really sort of, not very common at all in a country like the United States, for instance, or even in other countries in Europe. And then there were a number of other factors. I mean, the government had a sort of subsidized home computer program where anyone employed, either in the public sector or maybe even within the private sector too, could get a pretty large subsidy for getting a home computer. And so I remember getting, while Jonas sort of became an adult around those types of years, around the sort of turn of the millennium, I am 3 years younger than Daniel Ek, but we have a kind of similar background in that we're both from Stockholm, and I also sort of used Napster when that was in its heyday. And around that time, in terms of file sharing, there was a lot of buzz around that in Sweden, and there was a sort of sense that, I mean, Napster, of course, was a U.S. service, but it really spread rapidly. And the Pirate Bay, obviously, and Kazaa before that were two file sharing services that originated from Sweden. And there was a sense that in the music industry, at least, that Scandinavia was sort of a lost cause, or perhaps going to be, at least. Piracy was rampant, and that's, of course, later an important part in why Spotify got to try out its business, its service in the Nordic region, because essentially, I mean, I think the labels felt that was sort of, you know, any shot, they were willing to take any shot to sort of save the industry there, because things were looking so down. I mean, it was basically the Nordics, particularly Sweden and China, that was sort of made up these like dark red spots on the map, the sort of alarmist maps of piracy that the sort of industry associations would push out at the time. So that's it's actually, you know, piracy was quite common and it had a lot of roots here, but it was also a reason that I think Daniel Ek saw the true potential of a strong, widely used music service, and it was also a reason that they could even start to begin to try to convert users into something else.
Yeah, and also iTunes launched rather late. The iTunes Music Store launched rather late in Sweden, so piracy had already caught on, and iTunes never really caught on in Sweden. Niklas Zennström, who founded Skype, also founded Kazaa, which was a file sharing, the biggest one in 2003. And then you had the Pirate Bay coming out of Sweden, which sort of was big when Daniel was starting Spotify. So there was a lot of inspiration in Sweden. Also, MicroTorrent was started by Ludvig Strigius, who became a Spotify employee. They had the piracy star, you know, in the first year as part of the early crew there at Spotify. So, and they used peer-to-peer technology. So, I mean, they were so much a part of that and then grew out of that. They saw piracy is what's going to rule the world. We just want to make a legal version of it. And the one question and answer with Daniel Ek that we do have in this book is, I went to this open house that they had at Spotify and they invited a bunch of journalists. And I asked Daniel, what's the secret to your success? And he said, I'll give you two reasons. And one reason was that they were a free service or a freemium service. And they've always been free, not just for 3 months, but forever. You can use Spotify for free your whole life if you want to. It's restricted in some ways, but the number of songs are the same in the free version. And the second reason was that we started in Sweden and grew country by country. And by that, he meant that there was a tolerance from the music industry that Sweden could be the first little laboratory to see how far this went. And then they could build on that. And so they launched in England fairly early. But of course, launching in the States became the big sort of challenge, the sort of life or death challenge in the first years of Spotify. And a lot of the drama in the book, of course, it revolves around that.
Yeah, I think, and just that free tier remained, and to this day, to an extent, remains quite controversial, both among artists, but also with the labels, because I mean, as critics would put it, that subsidizes Spotify's growth at the expense of their competitors and gives music away for free. But that's, you know, that's been a point of contention since the very start.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the fact, you know, the music companies accepted it in part because it was rolled out country by country. But as you set out in the book, the first couple of years, he was really fixated on the idea of getting global music rights. And it was only after this one meeting in New York where he basically abandoned the idea. And so in some ways, he was helped in the long term by what he was not able to do.
Yeah, I think it might be to his credit that he had a vision of a completely free service with no premium tier at all, and global. And that was where that was his starting point. And he held the vision of a free service with all along. And I think that's what has made Spotify successful. And then he had a compromise. And it might have been that meeting in New York. It's hard to know. People have a hard time remembering, but I think that some of his colleagues kind of convinced him that this is, you have to have a premium version also, otherwise you're never going to get the music licenses that you need to launch the service, and also we need to do it country by country because they're never going to give us an international license from day one. And so he accepted that and moved along with those challenges. And looking back, the premium subscription is why Spotify has a business model that looks like it can be profitable at some point. It's essential. It's an essential part. And that's why Daniel likes to talk about freemium business model instead of a free business model, which is his first idea. And the fact that they launched in country by country has allowed them to sort of grow and prove to the industry that they can be profitable and that they can grow in a responsible way. They've been able to point to Sweden as an example of where they're combating piracy and helping the record industry grow in a legal way and so on. So if you just keep at it and have a basic vision, then the company can be worth the problems that it's solving, which is the sort of the motto of Martin Lorentzon, the other Daniel's co-founder. That's what he likes to say, that a company is worth the number of problems that it solves. And Spotify had a lot of big problems to solve, and when it solved them, it became a big, huge company as a result.
Mm. Two very interesting characters in the book. I mean, it's full of some larger than life characters, but Rob Wells and Per Sundin from Universal, they seem to have been the two who latched onto this argument very early that you couldn't play whack-a-mole forever, and it was better to have Spotify than to leave the field open to the pirates. Do you think those two were quite decisive in the success so far of Spotify?
I think there were a lot of early champions, of course, and there are some who are sort of more outspoken than others. But yes, I mean, that was crucial to get the support of, not necessarily of the US side of Universal at this time, but of the sort of international arm of Universal, which is headquartered in London. Per Sundin, of course, was the Nordic CEO for Universal. And then there was Rob Wells, who was working on the digital side. I think he was VP, something along those lines, in London at the time. And yes, I mean, that's an early sort of crucial meeting where Daniel got an ally on the label side who chose to see the enormous potential that Daniel also saw, who sort of, I mean, as we understand it, believed in this from the get-go and became a really important proponent for Spotify on the industry side, but specifically with Universal, which is, you know, biggest record label. So that was, yes, I think so.
Both those two were important early proponents, but of course, in retrospect, even more so, right? Now that Spotify was the right choice, was the right side of history to be on, then, of course, so it's hard to know exactly who who was the most important voice in the room at any one time. But these are figures that have appeared on our radar. I would hesitate to point out any one or any handful of people as sort of holding the keys. Neither one of those two characters were able to make the actual most important decisions. So, you know, Daniel had to convince their bosses in order to be able to launch in the United States. And how they were convinced, I think it's a more complicated story. We get into it, and I think we found a lot of sort of keys, but I think a lot of the things that happened will sort of never be known. It's 2 years really of trying to unlock the door to the U.S. and get a hold of music licenses for all the four major record labels at the time. Eventually, it became three when EMI was bought. But when they were heading into the U.S., it was four labels that they had to get them all to sign on to the idea.
Yeah, and I hadn't realized till I read the book how, you know, how the record label saw Apple as this sort of protector stroke gatekeeper, that they felt that it was safer to stick with the company that was selling their songs at $1 a piece and guaranteeing 70% revenue going back to them. So to break through that did seem extremely difficult.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, there was also a problem, a potential problem, at least in the sort of reliance on Apple at this point. At one point, I think in the US, they had around an 80% market share for digital distribution of music. And of course, you know, that meant that Apple was a very important source of revenue for the industry. But it was also, you know, one of the few, making them quite dependent on this model that was, I mean, at times felt like a sort of back of the envelope sketch, $1 a song kind of thing, which also broke up the album, which was of course a major shift in terms of how we consume music. So I mean, Apple was a dominant force for Spotify, but there was also some sense in which, you know, the labels, and we see that today, I think, benefit from a variety of platforms to use as distribution for their music, whether that be various streaming services or social media or sync or whatever types of way they want to sell their music. I mean, I think that sort of puts them in more of a position of strength. And so while labels were at times, especially I would say Warner and Universal, were quite wary of not sort of upsetting Steve Jobs or Apple too much. There's also, they had a lot to gain from being able to negotiate with various parties.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, I mean, now where are we? 14 plus years on, and as the results this week showed, that, you know, Spotify still hasn't made a profit, and the assumption among analysts seems to be that it is largely down to the structure of the deals that it has had to do with the music, with the recording companies. What's very striking reading the book is really from, you get a sense that from sort of 2012, 2013 onwards, Ake is looking for any ways to, over the medium to long term, to break away from this stranglehold. But each time that, you know, baby steps are taken, he has to go back because they are so dominant in this relationship. Do you get any sense that is starting to change?
It seems like podcasting is like his new way out of that problem, that dilemma. Because for a while, like a few years ago, it looked like Spotify might become kind of a self-publishing platform for musicians, and that that would threaten the record labels. But I think that the record labels have objected to some of this two-sided marketplace business that Spotify has been planning, and so they haven't really been able to pursue that full on. And I think Spotify now looks at music as this can be marginally profitable, but on top of that, we're going to add other types of audio, and we're going to try to do what Netflix does. We're going to try to own our own content. So we'll be a Netflix for podcasting with exclusive podcasts mixed in with lots of podcasts that are widely available and generally available. And that will make people use our platform for all things audio. And we can find ways to make money on our on the content that we ourselves own. You know, they've invested $1 billion in buying various podcasting companies, and the content, and they have four of their own podcasting studios making their own content. So owning the content is, I think, what's excited the market and made the stock go up. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but I think that the music might just become sort of the backbone of a business that finds other pathways to profitability. At this point, it looks like that's the kind of the plan.
And actually, I was surprised because you, I think very early on in the book, you describe how when they were building the original platform, they saw it as an agnostic streaming platform. So the idea always was that this was not something that was going to be only for music right from the start.
Yes, and that's kind of the point about speaking about this in hindsight, as Jonas was saying earlier, in terms of who were the key people involved. I mean, looking back now, there's a lot of people willing to take credit. And there's a lot of people, you know, the sort of opponents of Spotify over the years are perhaps, you know, a little less forthcoming when we talk to them. But of course, this was a negotiation all along. So they helped shape what this service would be too, of course. And I'm sorry, what was your question?
Well, I think that Tim was talking about the fact that they were thinking about television and film from the very
early on
years, and they did, of course, venture into this unsuccessful television venture that was sort of quieted down and buried, way beneath the floorboards, and that we have a chapter about in our book called Spotify TV. They built something comparable to Apple TV, also comparable to cable television, and the technology was great, but they weren't able to hammer out the license agreements in any way that looked reasonable, and it looked like it was going to have to become so expensive that they had to sort of bury the whole idea,
It's a very crowded marketplace.
Exactly.
That too,
and now that when Daniel, after our book has been published, gets questions on this, then he says, well, at least we didn't spend too much on that, because looking back, having spent, I don't know, $10, $15 million or something like that on this, it doesn't look like it's that much money, you know, if you compare it to what Spotify is worth today. But when they were venturing into this in 2012, 13, 14, 15, and they had more than 70 people working on this project and stuff. It was a pretty big risk, you know, and it was a kind of a major failure. But to Daniel's credit, he pulled the plug before it was too late. So probably at the right time. And I think they learned from that they want to focus on audio, and that there's something about listening that ties it all together in the app. People don't want to switch from, you know, listening to something when they're out jogging or running or walking with a baby carriage to watching the screen. And, you know, with it. So none of the formats that they tried out worked very well. So I think that they've done the right thing now in understanding that they're trying to be king of audio. And that's what this whole experience has sort of led them to conclude. This is our home court.
Yeah, in some ways, the pandemic should have done them some favors. You know, people are desperate to get out and exercise, but at the same time, they're not allowed to mix with people, so somebody else needs to entertain their ears.
Yeah, I think absolutely that this is something that you know, you can bring you in your solitary everyday activities. Spotify can be with you in a way that Netflix can't, that really hardly anything else can. You know, you can do laundry and listen to stuff in your Spotify app, and so it's really it's a killer app if you have like the best audio content. You know, so we'll see going forward if they add audiobooks or what the next step will be. But I think for the coming years, the podcasting play is gonna be where you see a lot of sort of leaps and strides.
Yeah. But as you were mentioning, I mean, it's video used to be and still is a very crowded marketplace, and audio is too. I mean, name a large tech company that isn't focusing on podcasts these days, even developing original content. And so there's a lot of competition. Spotify's finances are, as you mentioned, I mean, they have turned a profit in terms of over a quarter, I mean, over a handful, fewer than 10, but still quite a few quarters since they went public. But their margins are slim. And right now it looks as though podcasting will be the way in which they try to change that. And, you know, we're quite early in terms of the size of the podcasting market, but also in terms of Spotify's push into it. So we'll see. I think one key component that they'll have to work on is developing more of an ad revenue stream. And that's, you know, that changes sort of how the business operates. It changes how they process data, which can be contentious with users. Spotify has had run into trouble when they've updated their data privacy policies in the past, because there's been sort of a bit of outrage among users on the internet. And so, you know, we'll see where this takes Spotify, but they do have to do something about their returns, because, you know, that eventually their market cap, which has grown, you know, significantly over the course of the pandemic, will have to be sort of defended in terms of profits and not just a multiple on sales.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, I think you point out in the book how long Netflix and Amazon in particular went without making a profit, simply grabbing market share. It is something that is quite, a feature of this market segment.
Yes, this is true. And that it's not necessarily a, to your disadvantage, but there's only so many Jeff Bezoses in the world, I suppose.
Yes. One thing you write about quite a bit is the culture of the company and how it changed. I think, you know, some of the original engineers quit when they felt it was turning, in inverted commas, too American. And you're also very interesting in cultural difference between one of the engineers who is a social democrat from northern Sweden and another who's a sort of liberal from Stockholm. Is that something that's continued, you know, since the book is written, since the book was finished?
I think that was sort of emblematic of the early days, especially because there was this ideological sort of current in Sweden where sort of file sharing was becoming the norm, essentially, and a lot of people were not just doing it because they wanted to get, a music library for free. They also felt that ideologically somehow this was how the internet was supposed to work. And that was the one of the key aspects in which Spotify has really succeeded is the way they've been able to transform as a company. So they started out as very technologically focused. They wanted the best tech. They wanted the best platform out there to get a product that was just, you know, world-class. And then they began to commercialize the service. And that's where a lot of this friction occurred, which you're referring to in the book. And then they've continued to transform the company into, I mean, at one point it was video. They've pivoted so many times over the years. And we don't necessarily see that because they're quite secretive about what they do. But they've really been searching for the sort of right recipe for a long time. And podcasting is just the latest attempt. And it's, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look back to like the years after they entered the US market in 2011, you know, when they were competing with Beats Music and Pandora, the algorithmic playlist that Discover Weekly became on Spotify Radio, that was like the big technical shift from the sort of European computer nerd lean forward and create your own playlists to sort of the more American style of just press play and select one song, and it just keeps on, it understands, mm-hmm. The computer understands what you want to hear, and it works more like turning on the radio in your car or something like that. So Spotify was inspired by some of the American companies that were ahead of them, and they sort of surpassed them with Discover Weekly. That was a big hit, and algorithmic playlists that sort of are based on what people like and listen to. So they're based on like sort of what human, what actual humans are listening to, what all their consumers are listening to. But then the algorithms sort of combine all this data into like playlists that you fall in love with right away, kind of, in the best of cases.
Yeah, that alarming quote from Daniel Ek where he says something like, you know, he wants people listening to Spotify from the minute they wake up to the minute they go to sleep. So you'll essentially have a soundtrack to your life with AI knowing exactly how you feel at any given time.
That was around the time when they had to implement that, they had to change their privacy policy. And that's when that sort of online outrage happened. And so they sort of have readjusted, I think, their messaging a bit. You know, that was about 5 years ago. And I think the privacy discussion is elsewhere today than it was then. But we do see now that, you know, patents that they file for include, you know, quite sophisticated sort of audio based personalization of sort of ads and profiling users in terms of not just what they listen to, but perhaps even, you know, more data than that they can try to obtain through their platform. So you know, there is that sort of tantalizing prospect of basically making more money in more sort of sophisticated ways. But it's sort of a tricky path to go down, as we've seen for companies like Facebook and Google.
Yeah. Right. At the end of the book, or very, very close to the end, you have this quote from an unnamed source, quote, Daniel and Martin have always wanted to negotiate with companies like Microsoft, Google, and Tencent to understand the strategic value of the company. I don't think they ever had the intention of selling, end quote.
That's hindsight, if anything.
Yeah.
That's partially hindsight, but I think it rings true to a great extent. Daniel loves to get up on stages and talk to startup founders and talk to a European audience and tell them, don't sell your company to the Americans, don't sell your company to the Chinese, keep on building. We can also build world-class tech companies here in Europe. I think that's the way he's felt about Spotify for the most part, but he has been no stranger to negotiating the sale of his company. And then the people that are close to him will say, oh, well, yeah, he did, but he just, you know, he mainly was curious to see what is it worth? What would it, how would it fit into Google? Some people say, oh, you know, if they'd let him merge Spotify with YouTube and he could be the head of that, then he would have said yes. You know, some people say if he'd, you know, been offered enough money, he would have said yes. It's hard for us to know. I mean, it's hard for even him to know, I think, because you sort of rewrite your own story, even in your own mind. But
I mean, there is one moment which you'd sort of have to hand it to him for. This is in 2009 when Spotify is, you know, a European service, essentially with headquarters in London. And Kara Swisher, you know, podcaster, tech journalist, travels there to interview Daniel for the site she then worked for, which was All Things D, I believe, under the Wall Street Journal. And so it's a video interview. It's sort of, you know, young Daniel, you know, looking boyish in this sort of bleakly lit office room, anonymous place. But she asks him, you know, what's the end game here? You know, you're it in Silicon Valley. Are you going to, you know, be acquired by a U.S. company? And he says, well, you know, my hope is actually for us to remain independent and for us to show the world that we can do this from Europe and maybe start acquiring U.S. companies. And that's, you know, it's a bold statement from a 24 or 5-year-old, however old he was at that point. But it really sort of, I mean, that is how it played out. And so we don't know if, you know, of course, things could have taken other turns. They had negotiated with Tencent. We've heard talk about discussions with SoftBank. You know, there's you know, any number of scenarios that could have actually played out just as well, I think. But in hindsight, when you look back at that kind of material, you kind of have to hand it to the guy, you know?
I think that one test that he had, according to some sources, is that if merging with another company would improve the service, then that could be a reason. And I think that Google was that kind of a company where he felt like this could be a good fit if I'm still in charge of something, but if I don't just become some little poor part and I get phased out and stuff. So I think he never felt confident enough that Spotify would improve by being sold to any of these companies that have negotiated. And I guess there's never really been an offer. It's never gone past the initial phases, these negotiations that we report on. It's easy to see the point that people that know Daniel well, have when they say that he never really wanted to sell. But I still think that's, it could have happened, but it wasn't really what he wanted in his heart. He wanted to be independent, and he wanted to build something big on his own.
Yeah. Well, finally, since this is a podcast about books, I asked you both to choose a book to recommend to listeners. What did you come up with?
Well, I would recommend Super Pumped by Mike Isaac, and it's of course right in the category. I thought it was such a fun read, and Travis Kalanick just being this tech bro character. It's such a comical, he's like a genius, but he competes with these wild methods and eventually becomes the enemy of his own company, and they have to force him out. And they compare him to sort of an alien intruder, sort of clawing his way into his own company and being thrown out again and again. It's just such a crazy fun story about a company that we all have that we all use. That we all sort of probably have mixed feelings about. I thought he really found a good balance there in how to describe that with a bit of fun, but also like some really, really excellent journalism going into that book. So Super Pumped by Mike Isaac about the Uber story.
Thank you.
Yes, good choice. I've been enjoying Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe, who's a New Yorker contributor. This is a book about, researched over many years, I imagine, about the troubles and the violence in Belfast in the late 60s. And it's really, super colorful nonfiction, colorful but accurate, based on tons of archival research and interviews. It taught me certainly a whole lot about the conflict, but it also reads like a thriller and almost like a true crime story as well. So I've really enjoyed that.
Great. Well, I've read neither, so thanks for the tips. Today I've been talking to Sven Carlson and Jonas Leijonhufvud about their book The Spotify Play, published in February by Diversion Books. Jonas and Sven, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Tim.